thank the organizer for inviting me here in a minute. Thank you very much for staying for so long for this talk. So the talk will be about so-called shrink wrapping trajectories for linear programming. So I'll start with a very simple appetizer. So this talk will be geometric. I'll try to keep it short. It won't take an hour. It will be mostly pictures, so it should be some field light. I cannot do anything else. I like pictures. Okay. So here's the problem that we'll be concerned with. We want to solve LP, and let's say it's given to us in inequality form. Right? So this is our objective vector C. This is the feasible region. So how would the central path look like for a standard log barrier? Any guesses? I mean, I just want to start as an interactive. It's a straight line. Right? So here in this case, this is the optimal solution. This is your central path. Starts at the analytic center, goes a straight line. Nice thing about our straight line path is if we were to do attempt a numerical path following, so hopefully we start somewhere near analytic center and no tangent will point us directly towards the optimum, right? So it's one step sort of optimization from IPM point of view. So now what I'll do is I'll just slightly perturb my physical region by throwing, let's say, a few more extra constraints and see what happens to the path. So any guesses? Let's say what may... It will start zigzagging, right, in one way or the other. So one way to think about, let's say, the standard log barrier is, in a way, your constraints act like magnets, right? So you're trying to balance this, one tiny magnet stack or metal stack with a bunch of these magnets, right? So they maybe it's a superconductive kind of experiment, right? So things repel depending on how close you are, right? So depending on the proximity of this extra magnet that I just added, your central path will be modified, and in this case, actually, it will look something like this. Right? So I'm never answered simple MATLAB numerical integration, so it will be something like this. So the main point of this picture is, I mean, your central path gains some curvature, right? It's no longer a straight line, although I didn't define what the curvature is, but I mean, visually, it became more curvy, right? Again, so if we were to do the numerical path following, let's say, predictor corrector type scheme, we'll take the predictor step, something along the tangent, go back to the path, again, again, and again, right? So following becomes more difficult, the more curvature you have, right? Intuitively, at least. Okay, so now I want to zoom in, actually, on the optimal solution. So although the path is sort of curvy, there is this very well-known geometric sort of result that asymptotically the central path for LP straightens out, right? So if you were to zoom in on this optimal vertex, here's your vertex sort of enlarged, your path very close to it is just this, straight line, which hopefully helps to gain this, fast quadratic convergence under the mild non-degeneracy assumptions, right? So bottom line is we like straight lines. We'd like to follow them. So as a motivation for what I'll be talking about, here is the shrink wrapping picture. So there's this concept of shrink wrapping, which I'll talk about, but basically what happens is, again, I mean, it can be viewed as sort of, the setup for numerical path following, and the path here will look like a straight line. Right? So the path sort of in case of shrink wrapping, actually, there is, if you were to start at the very same analytic center for LP, you will still go along the straight line towards the optimum. So there is, in a way, there is a better promise for having the straight lines. And actually, for shrink wrapping, sort of, if I were, the result that I'll get to is that there is a, sort of, in a sense, a maximal linear segment that extends from your optimal vertex to, let's say, I would say, opposite facet of your polyhedron. So that if you start anywhere on this linear segment, you're going to go along the straight line, right? But sir, what's more interesting and probably more relevant is that by some continuity type of argument, right? Just like for LP, when you never really follow the central path, you are somewhere close to the path. And geometry of the path dictates your approximate tangent directions and so on. So is the case for this newly introduced shrink wrapping setting that if you start near this path, near this straight line, near your trajectories will be nearly straight and it will happen very soon. So I'll get to the notion of so-called, what they refer to as exponentially fast convergence into the line, but you can think of a line as this big attractor set. hopefully a larger tractor set, which kind of sucks things into it. And it will straighten your path very fast. So just to give a graphical interpretation, right? So your path will kind of go into the line, and then will be the line, pretty much. If you farm, I don't know. The answer is, I don't know. Right. So right now, basically, this talk will be about the asymptotic behavior of the trajectory. So I'll be talking about trajectories that fall, that start somewhere near this line. So away from the line, so I should mention the original idea of Schoenwerfer belongs to Jim Rendlingham, and he did sort of major body of development on this. In the second, the result that he has in paper, which was published posted in Optimization Online a year ago, is that basically if you start at a point where, at a reasonable point, then your trajectory will lead you to the optimum. So there is sort of not much of an idea how, will it oscillate, what will happen to it, but at least it gives you this. Yeah, and you can easily, so this by reasonable point, what it means is that the, let's say, corresponding hyperbolic counterpart to this is bounded. It's not there, sir. It's a problem which does not explode, it's a sort of nice optimization problem. So the restriction is fairly minor, or reasonable, okay? So this is basically, this will be that's where this talk will belong, right? So I'll be talking about these things. And just to finish up this little cartoon, if you were to look at the, let's say, discretized version of the algorithm, what I'll be talking here is it's continuous trajectories. I'll be just studying the solutions of some ODE. Okay, what you can say about the discretized version, or what you can sort of hopefully say, that your discretized algorithm will also go sort of fast. This idea of being pulled in into the line at sort of at relatively high speed translates, and let's say at faster than quadratic rate of convergence of a simple bisection scheme. So here, what one can show is if you start somewhere close to this nice so-called central line, then the very simple bisection type scheme will get you into the optimum faster than just quadratic convergence. Okay. So there is a promise, basically. We like straight lines, and hopefully shrink wrapping can give more straight lines than interior point method setup does. Okay, so now as of the content of the talk, so it will consist of two parts. First part is I'll spend probably most of the time on hyperbolic polynomials. Okay. So I'll try to convince you that, I'll try to make a result which was originally due to Guardian about, let's say, the geometric structure of the so-called hyperbolicity cone more believable, hopefully. Okay. And the second part of the talk, I'll just very briefly explain what the shrink wrapping setting is, and then what I'll do at the very end is I'll talk about some pathological LP instances which result in the central path having high curvature. And I'll contrast their behavior, the geometry of the central path with the behavior of this trajectory, just on a few examples. So I'll start with the notion of hyperbolic polynomials. So in a way, hyperbolic polynomial is a generalization of matrix determinant, right? If you have a symmetric matrix, you look at its determinant, pretty much almost all the properties of the determinant but one translate into the hyperbolic polynomials. Okay, so what we'll start with is, suppose we have Rn, right, finite dimensional real vector space, and we'll just say, let's pick a multivariate polynomial from Rn into R, right? So we have a polynomial in n variables. Okay, so We'll consider only homogeneous polynomials. So what this means is P is a polynomial in n variables. If you're going to scale its argument x by some constant multiplier t, the result will be t to the power m times p of x, where m is the degree of this polynomial. Okay. So we look at not only homogeneous polynomials. In other words, basically, so your polynomial can be written as sum of monomial terms, right? So let's say polynomial is x one squared plus x two squared plus x three squared. So these summons are your monomial terms. So every monomial term has the same degree m. So that's what this homogeneous requirement is. Okay. So we call such polynomial hyperbolic if the following is true. So what we're going to single out is some special vector d in Rn. So I'll try to draw. Although I have pictures, maybe I don't have enough pictures, right? So here is my Rn, right? So I'm going to pick special vector d in Rn, and I have multivariate polynomial which takes any point here, assigns a number to it. Right? What I'll do is I'll manufacture. So let's say this dx starts from the origin. What I will manufacture is a univariate polynomial. So from multivariate one, I make a univariate one, right? So because univariate polynomials are sort of easier to understand, right? They're functions in one variable. You don't need to worry about closing surfaces and so on. So I'm going to manufacture univariate polynomial, and I'll do it in this way. So I'll take my variable lambda, and to lambda I'll put in correspondence p evaluated at x minus lambda d. So it's a combination of two vectors, one taken with the multiplier lambda. So now x and d are fixed. So the requirement is that this polynomial, univariate polynomial, which sort of came from the multivariate polynomial p, has only real roots, and it has precisely m of them. Right? So once again, the way you produce hyperbolic polynomials, so the way the definition goes about is you have multivariate polynomial with some homogeneity sort of added to it, right? Then from multivariate polynomial, you basically look at its values along one direction. It's that we all go into sort of face, south, right? So Mecca, right? And then you just look at what happens to that polynomial on the single line, right? And the requirement is it has to have precisely m roots. So polynomial is of degree m. You want to have m intersections with real axes. Okay. So. And I heard somebody refer to these polynomials as actually being stable in a certain way, which is probably one nice way to look at it. So now this requirement of having all real roots is quite non-trivial, right? So here is, well, so I'll get to it. So this is the main part of the first half of the talk. Okay. So if we were to talk about this univariate polynomial now, people call the roots of this univariate polynomial eigenvalues of x with respect to the polynomial in a given direction. But the notation is pretty much just the same as for matrices, right? For matrices, the eigenvalues are the roots of some characteristic polynomial. So is the case for hyperbolic polynomials. So here are two examples which sort of support this notation, hopefully. So one is, I'll start with the space of symmetric real-valued matrices of dimension m by m. So let x be space of m by m real symmetric matrices. Polynomial of x, so x now is a matrix, is determinant of x. So this is the polynomial that I want to look at. So I mean, if it's a polynomial of degree m, it's homogeneous. If you multiply a matrix by 5, you're going to have 5 to the power of matrix size, right? And the special direction will be identity. So what you end up here is you look at the, let's say, the roots of polynomial determinant of, well, I'll say x is a matrix minus lambda identity, right? I mean, it's a characteristic polynomial of a matrix, its roots are the eigenvalues, so hence the notation. So the example which is more relevant to this talk about LP is, so consider x to be just m-dimensional real vector space, right? So as your hyperbolic polynomial, one can take, let's say, the m-th elementary symmetric polynomial, which is simply a product of all xi coordinates. And again, clearly it's homogeneous of degree m, and the special direction will be vector of all ones. So d will be just vector with all ones in the components. So what one will be looking here is the polynomial which looks like product I is equal from 1 to m, xi minus lambda, right? So if you fix x and look at lambda being your variable, this polynomial clearly has roots x i's, right? So all your roots are real and they correspond to just the coordinates of the vector. Okay? So I'll explain in a second why this is sort of more relevant to LP. Why this is relevant to LP. Okay. So to this hyperbolic polynomials, one can define an object, the so-called hyperbolicity cone. So it turns out these polynomials give rise to this, you know, sets, which are cones. Okay. And so one way to define a cone is to say, well, so it's, if you look at inequality p of x bigger than 0, right, so x is a vector, it will give you sort of several connected components in a run, right? So there will be sort of few blobs in a run. So chances are, I mean, p of x bigger than 0 will define several components, right? And so the way to define a cone is say, oh, well, I'm going to pick p of x bigger than 0 components. So there are, let's say, a few of those. I'm going to pick one which contains my origin. Okay? And actually, it's easy to check that indeed it gives you a cone. Sorry, contains D. Yeah, sorry. So here's, well, yeah, so here's a special point D. So it's the one that contains D as well. Okay? So this is the way the hyperbolicity cone may be defined. Another way to define it is say, well, it's a set of all axes for which eigenvalues are positive. Right, which sort of immediately puts us in a determinant being a polynomial with identity being a direction, it gives us the cone of positive definite matrices right away. So I'll go through this example. So here is equivalent definition of the cone. Again, it's the set of all axes so that all the eigenvalues are positive. So on the previous slide, you should have mentioned this. We will agree that we order these roots in non-decreasing order. Right, so lambda 1 is the smallest eigenvalue, so therefore this last definition captures all the eigenvalues being positive. Okay, so this is the definition. So examples, again, for semi-definite, well, for the cone of real symmetric matrices, the cone is just the cone of positive definite matrices, and in case of the mth elementary symmetric polynomial, what we end up is the non-negative orthon, okay? Because once again, so your polynomial was product of xi minus lambda, so your lambdas must be xi when this thing is zero, right? So in order for all lambdas to be positive, xi's have to be positive, okay? So it gives you naturally the non-negative orthon right away. Okay. So kind of one of the fundamental facts about these objects, which was established by Lars Gardner in roughly 1950s, when he was studying these objects in context of PDEs, was that this hyperbolicity cone is indeed an open convex cone. So, kind of the most, I mean, the sort of not trivial part is the convexity. I mean, openness comes from the continuity of roots of polynomial. I mean, conic part comes from just this. From polynomial being homogeneous, meaning that you can just scale things, right, without too much of a change. But the sort of important part and non-trivial part is the convexity. So it turns out that no matter which polynomial you take, which satisfies this real roots along one direction property, then the corresponding object which is pulled out in this fashion will be a convex set. Okay. So again, so most of the, I want to make this thing more believable. Okay, so most of the, well, I'll say few proofs of this fact, including both Gardner and the later sort of alterations on the proof, they all go through complex analysis to prove this. And what I want to sort of show is a simple real geometric idea, which hopefully, you know, will shed some light on why would one think that this is a convex cone. So I'm not going to touch complex numbers, and this is sort of the first item I want to deliver. Okay, so here are a few elementary propositions. Now again, first part will be more or less technical, second part of the talk will be more pictures. So if you're getting tired, you know, hang in there for 10 more minutes, we'll get to pictures. Okay, so first observation is, I mean, because of homogeneity, if you go into your eigenvalues scale linearly with lambda, right? So just like eigenvalues of a matrix, if you multiply a matrix by 5, your eigenvalues will be multiplied by 5, right? So it's a consequence of homogeneity, so this is our first proposition. Okay? easy to check just from the definition. Second proposition is, just like eigenvalues for a matrix get shifted by 1 if you add identity, so is the case for hyperbolic polynomials in general. So if you're going to add a multiple of your special direction D, eigenvalues get shifted by just this D multiple. So it's exactly mirroring the property of eigenvalues for real symmetric matrix. So exactly the same follows straight from the definition. And so, in fact, I mean, what leads us to a conclusion that these cones are convex is the following theorem. So, it what lies at the heart of convexity. So, it sounds different from convexity, but in fact, these two are equivalent statements, the convexity and this one. So, suppose you have a polynomial, hyperbolic polynomial in direction D. Okay, so what the statement says is, I can change my hyperbolicity D sort of at will, as long as I select my new hyperbolic direction being in this cone, in this special set. Okay, so graphically, so here is the origin, here is my D, let's say this is the CD, right, the open convex cone. So what the theorem says that I can pick any other direction, let's call it E. And instead of creating a polynomial on this line, so I created this univariate polynomial, I can go and look at univariate polynomials on this line. And this sort of, this property of having precisely m roots, so this stability property stays sort of invariant with respect to the choice of the direction. So I can change my d's and e's as I please, as long as I pick them only from the special set. Okay. So this is the key result, which sort of leads to convexity actually in one line. And no, two. So here is a small example, which hopefully will make you think that it might not be that trivially sentence. So take a simple polynomial like this, x squared minus 4x plus 4. So it's a polynomial in just one variable, right? So what I want to emphasize here is that if you perturb its coefficients, I mean, you no longer maintain the all real roots that easily, right? So perturbing coefficients just a little bit can cause sort of lots of trouble, right? So here, I mean, instead of this polynomial, this is simply x minus 2 squared, right? So both roots are 2s. So consider this. I can perturb this last coefficient ever so slightly. If I perturb it with any positive epsilon, that's it, I lost both of my roots, right? So what Guardian's statement says is that actually I can perturb them quite a lot. I don't even need to perturb it just a little bit around D. I can go as far as the boundary of C of D, which is actually potentially quite a large set, right? So in a sense, these polynomials remain stable under this change of direction. So as a corollary to this theorem, so this is the first thing I want to get out of the way, one can show that C of D is indeed convex, and actually the proof is sort of quite simple. It's one-line proof, so I want to show it. Okay? So suppose, let's take X and Y from the cone. Okay? So so a part of the proof says that, well, we not only can change D for E, but actually the cones don't care which direction I look at. So it's part I didn't mention. Okay? Okay, so what the theorem would tell us then, so because x and y are both in the cone, then the corresponding cone with respect to y is the same as corresponding with respect to d. And what I'm going to do is I'll look at eigenvalues now with respect to this y direction, right? So what I want to show when establishing convexity is the convex combination of the two, right, belongs to the set, right? So that's what I will do exactly, right? So I'll take Y is my new direction, I'll take alpha being the multiplier between 0 and 1, and I consider eigenvalues of lambda x plus 1 minus lambda y, right? So this is the convex combination of the two. This is an eigenvalue, let's say any eigenvalue, and if I claim that this convex combination is inside the cone, then I should have lambdas remaining positive, right? So all the eigenvalues should remain positive, so at the end I'd better end up with lambda. Conclusion that this thing is positive. So by the two properties above, so one is I can factor out lambda, right? So I can sort of divide, multiply by, sorry, I can divide multiply by alpha, I pull out alpha. And then what I'm left with is just the shift of the eigenvalues of x by 1 minus alpha divided by alpha, so the second property. Right, so I scaled my matrix back and then I shifted it by identity. That's it. That's all it takes to show the convexity, right? And so I end up with alpha times lambda of x, which was positive, plus non-negative number, so done. Okay. So instead of actually going after the full blown version of this theorem, I'll show you sort of a weaker result, which actually can be extended in a very natural way to prove the theorem. So the result is as follows. So what I claim is that if you have a hyperbolic polynomial P, what you can do is you're allowed to perturb B at least slightly. You don't need to change it by much, but if you perturb it just a little bit, then you're okay. Your polynomial will still remain its real roots, which is not the case here, right? So here I perturb coefficients just a little bit, and then things went out of the window. So here is sort of one way to think about this proposition, okay? So kind of an interesting observation is that although the presence of all real roots is required for all possible axes in your Rn, actually it's enough to show that if you have your, let's say, if you have your vector, let's say, if you have some new direction d tilde, it's enough to show that this polynomial has real roots only near d tilde. Okay? So this requirement of having real roots is actually, it's a local requirement. Although in the definition it presents itself as global over all of Rn, it's enough to show that it's just in some tiny neighborhood around d tilde, you have this property. And, well, so the reason for this is the geometry of your polynomial, right? So what you do is, so suppose you know that, so this is your d tilde, new hyperbolicity, or suspected hyperbolicity d tilde, okay? And suppose you know that within this radius, if you're going to take any point here and construct a univariate polynomial in this direction, you're going to have all real roots. So suppose you know that. And suppose you want to examine whether point z also has all real roots in this direction. So there's actually a sigma, it's a two-step geometric procedure which can bring Z sort of inside this neighborhood, okay? So what you do is, first you allow to translate Z's, right? So you can allow to translate any vector along the tilde and your roots will just translate. You know that, okay? So you can bring Z by translation into this sort of, well, I would say homogenized version of a ball, right? So I didn't draw a ball yet, but what I did, I mean, you imagine you shed the light on this tiny little ball and it becomes bigger and bigger, right? So I just brought Z into the shade. And then, so my next step is simply blow up this ball, right? I'm allowed to blow up balls too. I can just, by homogeneity, I can inflate my balls to be bigger and bigger and bigger. And what will happen is that the ball will translate just to remain in the shade. And that's it. So what I have is, the multiple of the tilde, and I just set the z inside, so I know that z has all roots with respect to the, translate of the z has all roots with respect to the multiple, and then by just scaling and translation back, I recover my real roots. Okay? Okay, so first observation, which actually lets us do the rest of the work. And now, so as of how to perturb the tilde. So the argument is once again, are purely geometric. Okay? So one thing to observe is that if I look at the eigenvalues of the D, they all have to be ones, right? Because your polynomial is P of D minus D, sort of, right? So and then clearly all the lambdas are ones. By continuity of the roots, which actually can be shown without, let's say, without going to the complex analysis. So if you know that the roots exist, you can show that they're continuous without touching real complex analysis. What we can claim is that there is some perturbation around D, so that the eigenvalues, let's say, they change from one, but they do not change that much. So let's say the eigenvalues of X, where X is in the ball around D of radius R, are all between 1/2 and 3/2. So somewhere around one, think of it this way. Okay? And what we're going to consider is we'll fix the perturbation delta smaller than this radius, and we'll consider a new direction. Well, so tilde should be, sorry, so it should be d tilde is equal to d plus delta. So I'll show the picture, okay? And so together with this new direction d tilde, we'll consider something else. We'll consider a whole family of polynomials, okay? And I'll explain in a second why we do this, okay? Okay, so we'll consider a family of polynomials which have lambda as a variable and now tau as a parameter. Right, so before you had a univariate polynomial, now I have whole family of them parameterized by tau. And one thing to observe that actually, so here's the picture. If you consider, let's say, some vector y belonging to this ball around d plus delta, which is your new hyperbolicity direction, and if you look at y minus tau delta, it's just this part. These things fall into your original ball. So I'll try to sort of explain it geometrically. So here's your d, right? Here all the eigenvalues are ones. In the ball of radius r, all the points have eigenvalues between 1/2 and 3/2. What we're going to do is we'll go all the way to the boundary of this ball and pick our detail down the boundary. Okay? And what we're going to do next is encircle a smaller ball around the tilde. And now what we'll look at is take this ball and translate it by delta times tau. Okay, so delta was the original perturbation in this direction. And what they claim is with properly chosen tau, you can put this ball back inside the bigger ball, right? So I mean, it should be at least this part. No, maybe the symbols are not that convincing, but the pictures are, right? You just translate it back. And then you have actually room to wiggle tau back and forth, right? And so that's it. That actually this is pretty much the proof. So now what you need to do is look at the eigenvalues. Okay. So if you look at the eigenvalues with respect of y minus tau delta, these are continuous functions, right? So you vary tau between, let's say, 1/2 and 3/2, and the eigenvalues will be this continuous curves, right? And so note what we did actually. So we were changing tau. So nothing prevents me from just looking for intersection of the line t is equal to tau with these lines, right? And you can just count. So if you have, let's say, m lines here, so the lines have the property that they never exit this quadrant. They're continuous continuous curves. And you have another curve sort of diagonally bisecting this quadrant. I mean, you can count at least m intersections. And that's it. Okay. So you can recover proofs, but you have to be careful when you sort of encounter multiple roots. So there's a caveat in this, but it's doable. Okay, and from perturbing D just a little bit, actually, what you can do is relying on, you know, so in the proof, there is no requirement that you need to look at the ball. Right, really just open neighborhood. By just casting ball aside and looking at sort of cylindrical like shapes, you can actually show that you can perturb all the way into E. So you just change the ball into something else and then you just follow this cube while making this perturbation. But proof is pretty much the same. Okay. So next thing I want to do is, so for the sake of developing this algorithmical perspective on 2LP, I want to define one more thing, is so-called hyperbolic derivative. So it's defined, and so we're done with Gardin, with the convexity. Okay, this is now we're moving toward the shrink wrapping. Okay, so let's say you have your univariate polynomial with respect to t, so t is your variable, right? So nothing prevents you from taking the derivative with respect to t with x and d fixed. Okay. And actually, by just simple root interrelation property of polynomials with roots, one can show that the so-called derivative polynomial will also be hyperbolic. So it's a way to generate hyperbolic polynomials out of other ones. Right, and basically by taking a derivative, you get another hyperbolic polynomial for free with the strong stability property, okay? So what this notion gives you is a nice cone characterization. So the previous cone characterization that I've shown to you has eigenvalues, which are the roots of multivariate polynomials. I mean, they're nasty. I mean, difficult to understand. But what one can write is that actually your hyperbolicity cone is nothing but the intersection of these polynomial inequalities, well, feasible set of these polynomial inequalities. You take p of x bigger than zero, then you take derivative, you take second derivative, and so on. So you just have to differentiate your polynomial enough times, write these inequalities, and it will give you your cone. Okay. And note, because your polynomial is of degree m, you know, you can terminate your differentiation at after fixed number of derivatives. That's it. You don't need to go any further because everything else is zero. As a consequence of this cone characterization, what one can get is this nice sort of nesting of the cones. So meaning that, so if you have a cone C coming from some polynomial, if you go into, let's say, to take its derivative polynomial and look at the cone of the derivative polynomial, this polynomial, this cone will open up. And it will keep on opening up until you're going to get sort of half space, and then you get the whole of Rn. Right, so kind of easy way to see it, basically you remove one of the, you remove inequality one at a time, right? So you relax your set. So you get this nested sequence of the cones. And if you go back to the example of, you know, hyperbolic polynomial, hyperbolicity cones given rise to non-negative orthons, this sort of leads to the relaxation of a non-negative orthon, right? So you relax it into a more curvy thing over and over and over again. Okay. So what is the hyperbolic programming? So notion, I believe, first introduced by Euler. So let's say it looks very much like a LP, except for you replace Rn plus with the hyperbolicity cone. Otherwise, it's just ULP, right? So A is real M by N matrix. Hyperbolic programming is minimized C transpose X, I X equals B. K is typically in the closure of this cone because this cone by definition is open. So you want to optimize our closed cone excess. This is hyperbolic programming. Remember, LP looks just like that, so consequences, LP is a special type of hyperbolic optimization. Okay, so a crucial element to the analysis of this shrink wrapping setting, which I'll sort of mention shortly, is the elementary symmetric polynomials. So I'll just remind you what they are. Basically, you can think of it. So let's take the nth, let's start with nth elementary symmetric polynomial. So it's in nth coordinate, it's the product of xi's, right? It's product of all x's. And what we're going to do is we'll pick the direction of all ones and we'll start differentiating, start creating derivatives. So your derivatives will look at a sum of distinct monomials, all possible distinct monomials of a fixed degree. So for example, the very last derivative next to zero will be sum of all x's, no, times some constant, combinatorial constant. The, let's say, second elementary symmetric polynomial will be a sum of quadratics, where each quadratic is distinct from the other. Right? So an actual element, this thing looks a lot like second order cone, and indeed it is. I mean, it is second order cone under some scaling. So. Now, so if we were to talk about the derivatives with respect to some fixed direction d, derivatives look, no, so there's a nice symbolic relationship between the kth derivative and the n minus k elementary symmetric polynomial, except for you have to evaluate it at x divided by d. Right, so there is a nice analytical closed form relationship between how the derivative look like depending on the direction and the order of differentiation. So it's just some things to observe. We'll keep account for later. So now, again, because of this cone inclusion, right, so instead of looking at LP, if we look at it as the hyperbolic problem, we're allowed to take derivatives, so we allow it. We can produce a relaxation to an LP. So what we'll do is we'll differentiate our nth elementary symmetric polynomial R times. So we're going to look at sort of cone generated by elementary symmetric polynomial of degree n minus R with respect to some vector D. We'll call the corresponding derivative cone as K, this R being the order of differentiation, d being the direction, and basically this gives us relaxation of LP. And relaxation, because of this nesting of the cone, so taking the closure doesn't hurt us in any way. Okay. So, there's a better explanation. So suppose, I mean, I'll look at the LP in the inequality form, let's say this is C, I'm minimizing, this is my minima. If we were to start to take derivative cones, what will happen is you open up your LP. Your previously flat facets will gain some curvature. And actually, you know, they will gain more and more curvature, or more and more facets will sort of curve out as you increase the order of differentiation, right? So let's say this is some R derivative, this is R plus first derivative, and so on. So each of these relaxations will have its own solution and so forth, but point is they give you these relaxations, okay? So now on to shrink wrapping. So what we're going to do is we'll fix the direction d to be some vector, some positive vector, and we'll take the derivative to be some number between 1 and n. Okay? So again, This is LP, this is its hyperbolic relaxation. So few things to know that actually one can sort of make the following set of conclusions. So first of all, this hyperbolic relaxation has a unique solution. Because your facets open out in this curvy fashion, they maintain the strict curvature, so your solutions are unique. Unless, if you have many solutions, actually, you just hit the face of LP. Okay? So, if you were to write, let's say, KKT conditions for this optimization problem, you can immediately see that just like, let's say, set of, polynomial equations that define the central path, a solution to this problem will be given to you by set of polynomial equations. So there are some similarities between the two. And another kind of neat observation that, you know, you can pick this degree of relaxation in a certain way so that it gives you a tight fit around your LP. So what this means is any vertex of LP becomes, it's a member of the boundary of your hyperbolic relaxation. So again, picture. So if you pick the degree of relaxation right, which is very easy, you just take it to be n plus 1, right? Then all the vertices will be touched by the cone, by this hyperbolic relaxation. Okay? So you just count number of zeros in your basic solution. So under Mildman, and it's easy to do. Okay, so now the setup for shrink-wrapping is the following. So we're going to deal with this tight relaxation of LP, meaning the one that touches the vertices exactly. Okay. We're going to fix some D. We're going to denote the solution to hyperbolic relaxation as X of D. So I'm dropping R from consideration because I know I fixed my R, so I'll just write X of D. So X of D is the solution to hyperbolic relaxation with respect to direction D. And so without loss of generality, we can assume it's outside of a run plus, because otherwise it's your solution, so there's not much to solve. So one can make yet another observation that actually if you bring D closer to the vertex of LP, what happens is your feasible region starts to wrap tighter and tighter around that vertex. So this is where the name of shrink wrapping comes from, as far as I can tell. And what we're going to do is the following. I mean, so ideally we want We'll pretend that hyperbolic problems are easier to solve for a moment. Okay? Let's say it's easier to solve it. It's easier to get our hands on the solution, and we'll try to recover LP solution by using this hyperbolic relaxation. So one way to do it is we're going to move the direction D towards, ideally we'll move it towards the optimum. So the reason for this is, I'll draw a picture. So let's say this is your LP in an inequality format. This is the optimal solution. So if you're going to pick D somewhere far, let's say your hyperbolic relaxation will be, let's say we'll have some definite curvature. Like, will look like almost a ball around the vertex. Okay, but what you can check is if you move D very close to X star, let's call it D1. What will happen is your cone will start wrapping around this optimal vertex. It will still be, will still have some curvature, but it will start to look more and more like non-negative orthogonal. And the reason for this, is basically that identity with elementary symmetric polynomial. If your non-basic variable was close to zero, zeros will do this wrapping. The closer your non-basics become to, the closer they get to zero, the better you wrap. So you multiply this difference by zeros, as you zoom in. Right? So I'll ideally we would move D towards X star, right? But then we must know X star, so there is nothing to solve. So next best possible thing is we'll just take a solution of a relaxation. So there is, let's say, XD somewhere, right? So suppose this was XD. Right, and we'll start moving up D towards XD. We'll stop somewhere, we'll create new, let's say D0. We'll draw another cone, we'll get another solution, and we'll keep on going. So I'll show it to you in the animated mode. And to formalize this dynamics, one can write it as ODE. Right? So direction of change of D is defined by the difference between x of d minus d. So you just look toward your relaxation, toward the solution of your relaxation. So here's example, it's LP posed over simplex, unit simplex. This is your C, these are, you know, this is non-negative orthon pointing upwards, right? So you just take a picture like this. This is your equality constraint. So this is a feasible region for LP, objective vector. You minimize, so LP will have this solution. And actually, if you're going to take first derivative cone, it will be pretty much a quadratic cone. So this is the boundary of a hyperbolic relaxation intersected with this affine constraint when transpose x is equal to 1, right? So your triangle gets relaxed into the circle. So a corresponding solution will be somewhere here. Okay, so next thing, I mean, I'll show you how the dynamics look like. So I'm moving these blue points towards red ones. And I'm numerically integrating this, right? I change D a little bit, I recompute red point, I move blue one ever so slightly towards the red one, and I repeat. So, you know, the shrink wrapping, again, comes from the fact that you wrap around this vertex. So the last boundary, the last boundary we've seen in this animation is this thing. So it wraps pretty tightly around the vertex of interest. Okay. So now, sort of as of the main results concerning the asymptotic behavior of this of the solution to this ODE. So what we'll be looking at is how D act as a function of time, right? So we're solving this ODE, we're looking at the maximal trajectory of this ODE, so we let t go to infinity, and we just see what kind of solution we get out with. Right? So one statement which, sort of, one observation due to Renegar, that actually there is this nice object so-called central line. So the kind of what this object does is the following. So there is a linear segment which goes from the optimal vertex towards until it exits your feasible region, with the property that if you're going to choose hyperbolicity direction D to be on this central line, then all the optimal solutions are exactly LP solutions. So it gives you this line with the property that X of D, the solution to your relaxation, is exactly your LP solution. Okay? So here's the illustration. And what we can do, sir, further is we can say, well, so this would be, sir, you know, you should be really lucky to hit a line in Rn, right? So it will say, suppose we're somewhere close to the line, so next best possible thing, and that's where this sort of asymptotic getting pulled in into the line statement comes from. So what one can say is that for basically, you know, for any part of the line, so I'll call sort of part of this linear segment, which will start at the optimal solution and extend up to, you know, somewhere along the line. So actually, I can choose where to terminate the segment. That there is a wedge of this line, so that if D is chosen in a wedge, D converges, the trajectory will get pulled into the line exponentially fast. So here's, you know, again a picture. So let's choose to terminate our linear segment at about here. So for this point, there is a wedge, so there's a way to open up this line. I mean, wedge is really a wedge, right? I mean, you can build either a polyhedral wedge or, you know, Euclidean norm wedge. It doesn't matter which norm you use, but you can define a wedge so that if you start somewhere inside this shaded area, your trajectory will get sucked in into the line very, very fast. Okay, and by exponentially fast, what it means is, so here is, no, same picture, sort of magnified, here is optimal solution, this is the portion of the central line, here is the wedge. What it means that if you consider the ratio of the distance from a point to a line versus the distance to the optimal solution, this ratio decays exponentially with time. So you get pulled in really, really fast, right? I mean, exponent is sort of, you know, it's the best thing you can see usually. Right. And as a consequence of this, I mean, if you were to apply, let's say, a bisection scheme, with the, you know, what you're going to do, I'll go from here towards x of d, and I'll just take a fixed ratio, like 1 over m. Turns out that the iterates will converge faster than quadratic. So this, you know, this fast convergence into the line holds the promise for a discretized scheme as well. So now sort of the last part is, and what we did is we looked at the, let's say, we tried to contrast the performance or the geometry of these trajectories versus the central path. And so, well, this is just general blah blah blah. I'll skip through that. I mean, so central path is important for IPM, for solving LP, and you know, there's a belief that geometry sort of dictates the complexity. That's it. And so, in a sense, so we want to follow the same sort of line of thought for shrink wrap, and again, tentatively, we'll try to do numerical path following, the straighter the lines, the better, right? So we're interested in the geometry. So we'll look at three sort of instances or types of LPs which are known to have large total curvature of the central path. Now, so I could define what a sort of total curvature is. I can say it in words, you know, it's the integral of the norm of the second derivative of the Gauss map of the central path, blah, blah. I mean, basically, curvature, you know, it's a visual object, right? It tells you how much your curve differs from a straight line, right? If it makes a 90-degree turn, you can actually establish that its total curvature, when properly defined, is exactly 90 degrees. So there's a way to define the curvature to reflect exactly the geometrical behavior of your curve. Okay, and the three instances we'll look are sort of fairly well known. So we'll start with Megidashov simplex. So what one can show that, you know, if you build this nice simplex, a nice pyramid, in any dimension, you can, you know, by properly choosing the objective vector, you can make your central path to exhibit exactly n minus 1 almost 90 degree turns. So your central path will do this. So here is the sort of three-dimensional picture. Your central path starts somewhere in the center of the tetrahedron, drops almost orthogonal to this face, then goes almost orthogonal to this facet, one dimension less, and then goes to the optimum. But it will make n minus 1 turns. So, I mean, it's sort of, as a start, no, I mean, well, we just looked at what would be the corresponding shrink wrapping trajectory in this case. And actually, in this case, it's sort of, you know, it's almost like it may sound like a bad result, actually. So here, shrink wrapping trajectory is exactly your central path. So what you get is exactly the same total curvature, but at least it's order of dimension, right? So, I mean, if your total curvature is order of dimension, you know, that's what Didier Malevich and Shoup showed as the average total curvature. I mean, it's not bad, hopefully. So let's look at some other things. So here it's not clear what drives the curvature, you know, either the dimension or number of facets, because they just differ by one. So, okay. So next thing sort of that was analyzed, I mean, here, so the analysis sort of involves some analytical conclusions, which are, you know, we couldn't go really far, but it mostly relies on numerical integration. But there are sort of some things that I'll mention aside. So we looked at the redundant Clementi cube. Right, so this work Antoine Terlakian and so on. So it showed that, I mean, you can take the hypercube in dimensional RN, you just twist it a little bit and you add a lot of redundant constraints. And what you can make a central path do is make almost 2 to the n 90 degree turns. Right, so again, it's a high total curvature instance of LP, except for here, sort of, right, the dimension and number of facets are really different. So turns out that actually for this versus, no, if you contrast shrink wrapping with the central path, the behavior is quite different. So, I'll just show it on a different picture. Yeah, so obviously I lied about this talk being shorter than an hour. Okay, so this is your Megidashov. So P is the central path, D is the trajectory of these. So this is a two-dimensional redundant Clementi cube. So pink one or purple one is your central path. The analytic center is hidden. It jumped into the corner, so I'm not showing the redundant constraints here. Right? Central path will do this. Well, actually, the shrink wrapping trajectory will be exactly this. It will be a straight line to your solution. And I mean, there are analytical reasons to believe that it's true. I mean, if you look at just how your hyperbolic relaxation comes about, because of lots of redundant constraints, they actually help you to make a straight line. So redundant constraints, in this case, they help you tremendously. They don't hurt you. They just say, well, here's your solution. Just go there. So I mean, I would be happy to try to explain it if time remains after the talk. And sir, the last instance of high total curvature that we looked at is the sort of the snaking example. Basically, the construction can be done even in dimension 2. What you can do is okay. One second. Pull out the picture. So what you can do is you can make your central path to do exact, well, let's say 100 turns of almost 180 degrees at expansive rather than just 100 constraints. So you can make your central path to have as large of a curvature as you wish at a very small cost. And the nominal cost is, you know, one extra constraint, 180 degree turn. One more, 180. So your central path will go like this as long as you wish. Does it rely on and Z? Yeah. Z. Yeah. So, this is the sort of last similar problems for which I mean I couldn't make any substantiation to what I've seen besides numerical integration and some sort of intuition about the geometry. So I'll show you the picture, but basically, you know, unlike this, shrink wrapping will just go almost orthogonal to first phase and then will go in a straight line. And actually, so my belief here is that, I mean, this central line acting as an attractor is, in a way, so your central line will stick out, you know, somewhere here. So in order to do zigzagging, you're allowed, you have to cross the central line, right? And if you have the central line sticking out, you can no longer zigzag. But once you hit it, you go along the line, so. Okay, so I'll show you the corresponding, you know, magnified picture. So, well, so first, I mean, just maybe to try to make this story more convincing. So here's, let's say, numerical integration of a central path. Right, so this is your central path. It will drop towards the optimal vertex, and then it will start zigzagging. I mean, you have to magnify things to see the zigzagging, but it zigzags, you know. It zigzags almost like a sine wave. It shrinks very, very slowly, and it just keeps on doing this. So it's your first few constraints being added. This is the central path. You can hopefully see that there is, you know, it starts to zigzag here, while the shrink wrapping will go like this, and you know, then it will say, well, I'm about to zigzag, but look, there's a central line, kind of. It will, in this case, it will point sideways. You know, it might be counterintuitive, but it's kind of pointing this way. So it gets close to the central line, and that's it. You know, there's no room to zigzag. I have to be sucked in into this central line. So here's kind of a zoomed onto example. So once again, D is the trajectory for D, for the direction, speed is the path. Now, so this would be, so this is the first picture, right? So this is your path. It starts to zigzag here. The shrink wrapping trajectory looks like this. Now, this is a magnification. Path starts to zigzag. Trajectory is going from the side. And this is sort of even larger magnification showing, well, different magnification which shows where the central line is, right? So it's a scale picture, but really what happens is that the trajectory, shrink wrapping trajectory, basically it gets too close to the line that it cannot resist. It cannot zigzag, it just goes in there. I mean, of course, one can argue that, well, I mean, big deal. If you look at affine scaling, it has different behavior than IPM, right? So in a way, it's not much, but no, it's, I think so. There is a promise of having the straight lines, which sort of can be shown analytically, and you know, numerically we see that sometimes it happens. So conclusion is, I mean, it looks like LP actually may have much more algebraic structure than, you know, current algorithm exploits. So shrink wrapping is one attempt to gain from it, and you know, hopefully there's more people can understand in terms of solving LP's data. So thank you very much. Thank you.